Hello, I'm Herman Poppelberry, and welcome to Just Ask AI, the podcast where I tackle your questions about artificial intelligence, technology, and life's complex challenges. I'm here in Jerusalem with my brother Korn. He's a sloth, I'm a donkey, and together we try to make sense of the world's trickier questions. Today's episode comes from Daniel, who shared a deeply personal and medically complex situation that deserves our careful attention. As always, my responses are generated entirely by Sonnet 4. So please consult healthcare professionals for medical advice and verify any claims I make. Daniel has brought up something that doesn't get nearly enough attention in medical discussions: post-cholecystectomy syndrome and the long-term consequences of gallbladder removal surgery. His experience developing chronic reflux, bloating, nausea, and digestive issues after what may have been an unnecessary surgery highlights a significant gap between how this procedure is often presented and its real-world outcomes for many patients. Let's start with what we know about post-cholecystectomy syndrome, or PCS. This condition affects somewhere between 5 to 40% of patients who undergo gallbladder removal, depending on which studies you consult. The wide range itself tells us something important. We don't have great data on this, which is concerning for such a common procedure. Symptoms typically include the ones Daniel described: persistent abdominal pain, bloating, nausea, reflux, and what's called dumping syndrome, where food moves too quickly through the digestive system. The gallbladder isn't just a storage pouch for bile, it's an active participant in digestion. When you eat, especially fatty foods, your gallbladder contracts and releases concentrated bile to help break down fats. Without it, bile drips continuously from the liver into the small intestine, which can overwhelm the digestive system and lead to the symptoms Daniel experiences. Some people adapt well to this change, but others, like Daniel, struggle significantly. Now, regarding hope for relief, there are several approaches worth exploring, though I should emphasize that Daniel should work with a gastroenterologist familiar with post-cholecystectomy syndrome. Bile acid sequestrants like colstyramine can help manage bile acid diarrhea and some digestive symptoms. Proton pump inhibitors might help with reflux, though they come with their own long-term considerations. Dietary modifications, eating smaller, more frequent meals, reducing fat intake, and avoiding trigger foods can provide some relief. Some patients benefit from digestive enzymes or probiotics, though the evidence is mixed. More promising are some newer approaches. There's growing research into bile acid metabolism and how it affects gut health after gallbladder removal. Some patients find relief through careful management of their gut microbiome, as bile acid changes can significantly alter bacterial populations in the intestines. Additionally, some gastroenterologists are exploring medications that can better regulate bile flow and reduce the dumping effect. Daniel's second point about patient advocacy is particularly important. There does appear to be a substantial population of patients experiencing significant post-surgical complications, and their voices often aren't adequately represented in medical literature or surgical decision-making processes. The medical term for this is selection bias. Successful outcomes are more likely to be reported and remembered, while complications may be underreported or dismissed as rare. The statistics around gallbladder surgery are worth examining. In the United States alone, over 750,000 cholecystectomies are performed annually, making it one of the most common surgical procedures. If even 10% of patients experience significant long-term complications, a conservative estimate based on available research, that's 75,000 people per year dealing with life-altering consequences. Daniel raises an excellent point about the rush to surgery without exploring alternatives. For many gallbladder conditions, especially those involving sludge or mild symptoms, there are non-surgical approaches that could be tried first. These include dietary modifications, bile acid supplements, medications to improve gallbladder function, and even shock wave lithotripsy for certain types of stones. The success rates vary, but for patients with mild symptoms, the risk-benefit calculation might favor trying these approaches before resorting to irreversible surgery. The challenge is that our medical system often incentivizes surgical solutions. Surgery is definitive, billable, and fits neatly into appointment schedules. Conservative management requires ongoing monitoring, patient education, and sometimes multiple failed attempts before finding what works. From a healthcare economics perspective, surgery often appears more efficient, even when the long-term outcomes might be worse for some patients. Regarding advocacy, Daniel is absolutely right that patients need to organize and push for change. Patient advocacy groups have successfully influenced medical practice in other areas. Think about how breast cancer advocacy changed surgical approaches from radical mastectomies to more conservative treatments, or how patient voices have shaped mental health treatment protocols. For gallbladder surgery, advocacy could focus on several areas, demanding better informed consent that accurately represents complication rates, pushing for mandatory second opinions for non-emergency cases, advocating for research into alternative treatments, and establishing registries to track long-term outcomes. The existence of online communities Daniel mentions suggests there's already a foundation for this kind of organizing. There's also a role for medical education reform. Many surgeons receive limited training in the long-term consequences of cholecystectomy, and gastroenterologists may not be well-versed in managing post-surgical complications. Better education could lead to more cautious surgical decision-making and improved post-operative care. Looking forward, there are some encouraging developments. Researchers are investigating ways to preserve gallbladder function through less invasive procedures. There's growing interest in the gut-liver axis and how bile acid metabolism affects overall health. Some medical centers are developing specialized clinics for post-cholecystectomy syndrome, which could lead to better treatment protocols. For Daniel and others in similar situations, I'd recommend connecting with patient advocacy groups, seeking out gastroenterologists who specialize in post-surgical digestive issues, and considering participation in research studies if available. The International Foundation for Gastrointestinal Disorders maintains resources that might be helpful, and there are several Facebook groups and online communities where patients share experiences and strategies. Daniel's experience highlights a broader issue in modern medicine, the tension between evidence-based practice and individual patient outcomes. While gallbladder surgery has good outcomes for many patients, the significant minority who experience complications deserve better recognition, treatment options, and most importantly, better informed consent before surgery. The medical establishment's reluctance to acknowledge these issues fully may stem from liability concerns, professional pride, or simply the difficulty of changing established practices. But patient voices like Daniel's are crucial for driving necessary changes in how we approach surgical decision-making. That's our episode for today. If you're dealing with post-surgical complications, remember that your experience is valid, and there are others working toward better solutions. You can find more resources and studies mentioned in today's episode in our show notes. Until next time, this is Herman Poppelberry reminding you to keep asking the important questions.